And this is a project which I did with a bachelor's student, and he is basically pushing this idea. So we should credit him for getting us both to think about it. Also, I should give some credit to Derek Wise, who is not here, but he kind of helped set up the mathematics, which made me believe that this could be possible. Okay, so. So anyways, I'll recredit Derek later when it's appropriate. So the motivation for what I want to do is I want to understand, well, there's a couple of different motivations. So I want to consider a kind of toy model for cosmology, which is basically just going to be maximally symmetric, homogeneous, isotropic shape dynamics with a positive cosmological constant. And then we're just going to put test observers inside. So inertial observers, which follow GUD6. And then in that, the context of that toy model, I want to show that I can give an explicit scheme for training the global symmetry. So Matteo just talked about the interesting fact that in shape dynamics, if we have closed spatial hypersurfaces, that we have to retain the volume. And that happens, of course, in De Sitter space, and the volume is the only degree of freedom of the geometry. But what I want to show is that there's a way to shade that away for a kind of scale invariant ontology. The second motivation is potentially more pressing as far as shape dynamics goes, which is how do we define, or is it even possible, okay, to show that it's possible to define shape observers in De Sitter space. But the real issue is whether or not you can provide a kind of clock synchronization in shape dynamics. What are shape observers, and how are they compatible with the clock synchronization that you would get in the space-time picture? Okay, so I just showed for the homogeneous case that that's possible, but you have to. But there are some interesting surprises. Okay, and the last motivation is just that this model has some interesting value of its own, in the sense that it provides it will provide, as I'll show, a very simple holographic model, which is purely classical. And so it might be interesting, if you're interested in holography, it might be an interesting thing to study just for that reason, without any motivation for shape dynamics. So let me just, I said in words what the model was. It's the maximally symmetric solution of the Einstein equations with positive cosmological constant. And you can show that, you can also show that this is the homogeneous isotropic solution of shape dynamics. The easiest way this is it, this is the De Sitter space. The simplest way to visualize it is to embed it into a flat manifold with one higher spatial dimension. And the definition is just in this embedding, the embedding is just given by the surface obeying this constraint, which is the T squared, it's a hyperboloid. And L is related to the cosmological constant. So now in shape dynamics, we only have manifest equivalence with general relativity in the CMC constant mean curvature slices. So what are the CMC slices of De Sitter space? They are just constant T hypersurfaces. So you just draw these planes, and where the planes intersect the hyperboloids, those are the CMC slices. Now, these circles, because I can't draw all the dimensions, you should think of them as not circles, but three spheres. And the idea is that we're going to just sprinkle inertial observers into one of these three spheres and watch how they evolve as the geometry changes. And given a set of initial conditions for these observers. Okay? So just because I'll use this alpha later, it's related to this T and the embedding surface by taking the cosine. It's a dimensionless proper time. You should probably add a factor of L to give you the proper time measured by a stationary observer. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to go over is what do GUD6 look like? Because probably not everyone is familiar with what the GUD6, how to get geodesics into sitter space. So it turns out that geodesics, in the same way you can get geodesics on a sphere by taking a plane which goes through the origin, these are the great circles, you can imagine taking a plane spanned by two null vectors, one future-directed and one past-directed, and look at where that plane intersects the hyperboloid. And that intersection is just the analog of the great circle, the great hyperboloid, great hyperbola. And those are the time-like geodesics of the sitter space. So the key thing here is that they're parameterized by these two null vectors, and in particular, they're normalized because you're just taking, well, anyway, they're normalized null vectors, so they're just giving you a direction, essentially, on the light cone. And so the past, so this phi in, chi in, is a vector which starts at the origin and points in the direction that this geodesic starts in the infinite past. So the idea is that this guy is telling you the initial position on the sphere, the three sphere, where the geodesic starts. And then the other guy is just telling you where the geodesic is going in the infinite future, in the scry plus. So a key feature of this, which is going to be very important later, is that these light cones, which you can barely see, intersect the hyperboloid in the future infinity and past infinity. And what that means is that any non-null observer, space is expanding at the speed of light. So any observer with mass won't be able to go anywhere. And the trajectory gets frozen. It starts off frozen and then it winds up frozen at a certain point just because space is expanding so fast that it can't really effectively move anywhere. Okay. The last thing that I want to say is that this south pole, so we can define a stationary observer at the origin of the sphere, which is just the observer sitting at the south pole. And we like to think of the events in this hyperboloid as being the coordinates that an observer sitting at the south pole would attribute to a particular event. So anyways, that's the idea. Now, how can we define shape evolution in this simple model? Well, the idea is to consider consider several geodesic observers. So this is our O. This is our guy sitting at the south pole. And this is some other guy sitting at some point. And this is a guy who's moving, okay? And these three, at some constant T hypersurface, so these guys label constant T hypersurfaces, at some constant T hypersurface, this defines a triangle, it defines a shape. And so the question is, well, then you can plot that shape at each one of these red lines, and you get, and you can just get some curve, which represents the shape of the triangle at any time. So so that's the model. And the question is, what happens to that curve if you do a Lorentz transformation, or if you do a symmetry transformation in the bulk? Okay. But before we can actually, I mean, I talked about having a bunch of points sprinkled in the sphere. So one way to actually talk about a shape in the way that Julian and Flavio and Tim were doing in their particle model is to think about stereographically projecting the points in the sphere onto the plane. So stereographic projection is simple. You just take you take a plane which is tangent to the sphere, and you call the south pole the point where the stationary observer is, and then you just shine a light on the sphere and see where the shadow that it casts. And the shadow that it casts will give you the actual shape. So that's explicitly how it can be, a way that you can define a shape. But now, here's the problem. The problem with defining shapes that way is that you have, in the bulk, you have this SO4-1 invariance, which is just the Lorentz invariance in the ambient space. This gives you a 10-parameter family of CMC observers, because the metric is invariant under that. So if you have one CMC observer, you'll have a 10-parameter family of CMC observers that should be equally good shape observers if you had a proper shape ontology. The problem is that boosts will not preserve the shape. And it's very easy to see that because the boost does two things. So this is what a boost will do to the hyperboloid. It will change the surfaces of simultaneity so that something that was an instantaneous shape here will not be an instantaneous shape, it'll be some different instantaneous shape for the other observer, the boosted observer. And then the other thing is the shapes get distorted. So if you have the same two points with the same position under the boost, they get rescaled. But if you have a different position, they get rescaled in a different way, which means that you're actually distorting the shape. So it looks like this is a big problem for shape dynamics because you have a degeneracy of CMC observers. You don't know which one to prefer. And each one of them describes a different shape curve. So the resolution of this is the mathematics was worked out by Derek Wise, but what we were doing is writing down an explicit model which exhibits this, is to use the isomorphism between this group, which is the isometry group of the hyperboloid, and the conformal group in three dimensions. And it's very simple. These boosts that I showed before near the boundary turn into conformal transformations on after stereographic projection. And basically, you can see for at very late times, the boosts don't tilt the hypersurfaces very much. And if you wait long enough, that becomes negligible. However, the boosts do shift the spatial part. And when you do the stereographic projection, you can find that it's exactly, for this boost, it's exactly a dilatation. Okay. So what happens is that 10-parameter family becomes the 10-parameter family of the conformal group with the special conformal transformations, the dilatations, and the Galilean group. So you can define shape observers, but only at the boundary. And so the solution, and this is basically my last slide, well, my last technical slide, and then I'll conclude, is that you can define a theory, which is a theory of shape dynamics, because it's invariant under the conformal group, which by using the geodesic principle in the bulk. So the idea is this is just the quantity which you'd like to minimize if you're trying to find the geodesics in the bulk. And then this will depend on the two endpoints of the geodesics, the initial point and the final point. But then what you do is you just stretch those points out to infinity, the infinite future and the infinite past. And what happens is that in that limit, this theory becomes the isometry group of the hyperboloid maps to the conformal group. And so this you can call the on-shell action of a shape dynamics theory, which depends only on the initial shape and the final shape. And you can use that to define the theory. So so I have my down to my last minute. So I'll just say that it's still the beginning, but I think this is a kind of interesting starting point for, it's a very simple model, which is holographic, and it could be explored more. You can work out all the equations. But more importantly, it's maybe a first step in trying to think about what observers are in shape dynamics, because in this model, you have to define observers holographically. And there's a bunch of generalizations. It's fairly easy to quantize, think about what the quantum theory would be, what the field theory generalization are. And of course, if you have interactions, then you can think about what to do about clock synchronization. So the only thing I'll say is that what's really interesting is figuring out how many of these features are just a feature of the maximal symmetry that we have, and how many features might be able to carry it over to the full theory. Thank you.
Other questions? So I'm repeat puzzle, but like you're trying to achieve. So the standard learning idea of CFT is that when you have a classical evolution on one side, then you have fully quantum or strongly coupled quantum evolution on the other side. Mm-hmm. So you cannot really have at least in a standard holography, you don't have like a weakly coupled classical evolution on both sides. But here it seems that you want to have basically a classical duality between the conformal basic picture and the space-time picture. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you want to learn any intuition you have from holography, that's not possible. So, I mean, what makes you think that it is?
Well, I just wrote down the Hamilton-Jacobi. Are you questioning whether this Hamilton-Jacobi functional is the functional of a real particle theory that this would give? You can explicitly compute. I agree that the normal ADS-CFT story is that you have a duality between a bulk. Well, the normal ADS-CFT is you have a classical quantum theory in the bulk and a quantum theory in the boundary. But the limits in which you can actually do calculations are usually a classical theory in the bulk and a quantum theory in the boundary. But in principle, you could probably try to do something like that. The interesting thing is this L, it pulls right out of the action, right? So all the dimensions pull out in this model because there's no other interaction that sets a length dimension. So it kind of acts like a H-bar. And you probably could define a kind of quantum classical duality using this L or something. But the point is that this is completely explicit. We know what the shape theory is. We know the ontology of it. We just use the stereographic projection to
map coordinates. But do you think that there is any point in the bulk has the corresponding point on the boundary and vice versa?
No. But what happens is that this on-shell action knows about everything that happened in the bulk. So of course, in this theory, it's kind of trivial because the only thing that happens is you have de Sitter expansion. But if you added interactions, then in principle, there would be a holographic imprint of those interactions on the boundary theory. So even though an observer here can't attribute a particular event, a space-time coordinate to an event, it still knows about the event in the sense that you have to kind of model the interaction between the how that observer found out that this event happened. And then that will be some interaction between a device and a thing. And that measurement will be imprinted into this theory.
Other questions?
Does that make sense?
Sean, thank you for the talk. It was very interesting. Can I just ask you, if I understood you say that in shape dynamics, observers should be defined as holographic observers, as you define them. And have you got a physical intuition about what that means?
So it's a good question. I mean, all I know is that in this model, that's the only thing that you can do. But this model has maximally symmetric, so maybe it's just really special feature of this theory that you have these different CFC observers, which are all equivalent. On the other hand, I think the way to generalize this picture to the more general case, where there's not maximal symmetry, is to have impose asymptotic de Sitter initial conditions and final conditions. And then you're still guaranteed to have this these two group actions, the group action on de Sitter space and the group action on the on the plane, matching up in those limits. And then potentially, that is a way to start. Anyway, that's a starting point. So, because then you have this nice thing where boosts and Lorentz transformations just correspond to dilatations and conformal transformations in this theory. But it's still too, I don't know how to do it yet. But that would be the appropriate scenario that I have in mind.
Right, there's no other very urgent question. I would thank our speaker again.
I don't need this one.
Okay, so
we have Mayesh from Perimeter, looking about black holes and ship dynamics.
So I may should use that too for
that
this
for
thing. Does this work? Well, I guess I can use. Yeah, I guess so. Well, thanks everybody. I know you had your choice of sessions, and I'm glad that you made the right choice to come to the right session, even though you're probably in the minority. So Flavia actually asked me to talk about cosmology because I'm a cosmologist by training. But then I realized that I have, I think, more interesting stuff to talk about that are not directly cosmology related. So I'm going to talk about that. So this is, I have very few slides, so feel free to interrupt me. This is the work with my very good PhD student, Mehdi Saravani, and Rob Mann, who is also a faculty here and at the University of Waterloo. And I'm both here at the University of Waterloo and at Perimeter. Good. So I guess just as a way of introduction, I just want to say that incompressible fluids that are not always known in this with this name, but they actually have been popping up in different places in the at least in theory universe, in the theoretical universe. And of course, this session is shape dynamics. I'm going to argue in a second why a study of shape dynamics in many ways similar to the study of the fluid dynamics of a truly incompressible fluid. Hojava-Lipschitz gravity is another example of that. And the way to think about it is that in Hojava-Lipschitz gravity, the idea is that very high energy gravitons propagate with a very, very fast speed. So if you look at, think about the quantum vacuum of Hojava-Lipschitz gravity, particles or excitations or vacuum fluctuations with very high energies, they propagate infinitely fast. So in that sense, the vacuum of Hojava-Lipschitz gravity is an incompressible fluid. Another example is something I've worked on, so-called Coscutan gravity. And that's just simply GR plus this type of action, where you have a square root appearing here on the kinetic term. Another example is if you look at basically a membrane paradigm, imagining that inside of the black holes are empty. And it turns out this membrane that surrounds the emptiness that would have been the black hole is an incompressible fluid. So these are all examples in the past few years where the so-called incompressible fluid had shown up in physics or in the physics of gravity. And in fact, there are other related occurrences. So the so-called DGP or massive gravities that have been very popular. They show superluminality. It's not necessarily infinite speed of propagation, but a speed of propagation faster than the speed of light, which one can show cannot be realized in any fundamental UV complete theory, which is Lorentz invariant. So these are, I claim, they are related. Early universe, whether how we can solve the horizon problem and get the CMB fluctuations. You can get that from superluminal near incompressible fluids. And even Einstein Eta theories, they have superluminal behavior. So this is a very common theme that occurs not only in shape dynamics that you're interested in, but in many recent developments in gravity that solve different problems, including quantum gravity, cosmological issues, black hole physics, and you name it. So one thing that's important to note is that one can easily show, just writing the equations, that incompressible fluid, i.e. a fluid that has infinite speed of propagation, or infinite speed of sound, it defines a CMC foliation, or constant mean curvature foliation. That means that if you look at evolution of an incompressible fluid, or a fluid with some speed of sound, in the limit that the speed of sound goes to infinity, the co-moving hypersurfaces of that fluid are constant mean curvature surfaces. So if you want to write gravity, any theory of gravity, in a CMC foliation, it's equivalent to general relativity, basically, plus an incompressible fluid, and I call it ether just for historical purposes. So it would be a fluid which is part of gravity.
And of course, depending on what your theory of gravity is, this incompressible ether would interact with gravity in different ways. As in some theories like shape dynamics, this incompressible ether is like a test fluid. It doesn't actually care for space-time. But in other theories, like in Hojava Lipschitz gravity, this incompressible ether actually does back react on GR. OK? 10 minutes, thank you. So next problem, and actually this is fully inspired by what you heard this morning about the fact that in some spacetimes have CMC foliation, other spacetimes don't have CMC foliation, and the only way to distinguish these kind of theories from GR is to basically look at the spacetimes that where CMC foliation breaks down. So one extreme example of that, the only one that we know for a fact does occur in our universe, is formation of black holes. And this is a cartoon of that, a Penrose diagram cartoon of formation of a black hole. So this is asymptotic spatial infinity. Some stuff, let's say a star, neutrino star, for example, collapses to form a black hole. And at some point, when it crosses 2GM, it forms a black hole and nothing can escape. And eventually it formed a singularity. The standard picture is that the space-time essentially classical everywhere until very close to the singularity, like a Planck length away from this, or Planck time away from the singularity. So I'm teaching astronomy this semester, and it turns out astronomers talk about singularity point, I guess you realize that the singularity is not really a point, but rather a time. Well, it's a point in time, so that's something, few people realize that, at least outside the community of black holes, general relativity. So this singularity happens at the time, not at the point. That's in the very same sense as Big Bang happens at the time, not at the point. So how does this picture look different in shape dynamics or any other theory of gravity, any of these other theories of gravity that I mentioned? So what Enrique said was that basically something happens at the horizon, so the CMC foliation, or at least some version of it, stops at the horizon, at least 2GM. So that was my initial guess. So we went out and did calculations, and it's essentially it comes down to solving this integral and the properties of this integral. So the idea is that you have a collapsing shell, and this is the simplest problem you could solve in basically formation of black holes. Inside the shell, you have Minkowski spacetime. So it's even simpler than this. So this is, say, collapsing a star. A collapsing shell, it's all the matter is concentrated in the shell. So inside is just Minkowski. Outside is just Schwarzschild. And all you have to do is to match the metrics and the CMC foliation, or the foliation, across this surface. And to do that, you just have to solve this equation, or do this integral, which is an integral for definition of CMC foliation. So f of r is just here, is just 1 minus 2m over r. K is the spatial curvature, which is some small number. If you want to match it to cosmology, where this k is the Hubble constant. So essentially, this k is 0 in this equation. There is an integration constant. What we call B, which is essentially the flux of ether into the star or into the black hole. So you have to actually be able to fix this constant in order to actually draw the CMC foliation. And there is an interesting behavior depending on the value of B, and that's what we think fixes the boundary of a space-time, classical space-time. And that's the fact that there's a critical value of B, so for values of B, bigger than that, there is no, basically, this is always positive, this denominator, under the square root. But then if B gets smaller than that value, then this goes to 0 and becomes negative. So that means that for those values of B, the CMC surface stops at some point because the square root cannot become, well, imaginary. So there is a minimum, essentially, for CMC surfaces, there is essentially a minimum value, a minimum radius for them. The other CMC surfaces go all the way to the singularity. You don't want those. And the ones that don't go to the singularity, they have a minimum value, which is 1.5 m, minimum radius. So this is how these solutions that we found look like for a collapsing shell. So this is in Kruskal coordinate, this is in Schwarzschild coordinate. This is the collapsing shell here, the same as here. And so this is a singularity in Kruskal coordinate. This is the horizon, or the Schwarzschild radius. Thank you. the pink region, the pink line, the pink curve, is this universal, or the boundary I mentioned, at 1.5 m, or 75% of the Schwarzschild radius. And what you notice is that, basically, if you do the proper matching at the shell, so that's an important part. You have to match to Minkowski in here. And then, basically, follow this CMC foliation, you see that they kind of pile up at this 1.5 m. So you have, basically, regular-looking foliation, but as you approach this 1.5 m, they kind of pile up, and they don't really cross it as asymptotically at late times. And the same is here. You can see it here. Outside 1.5 m, basically times go to infinity, but inside it essentially freezes. So that basically means is that even though outside the black hole time can go to infinity, inside the black hole surfaces pile up at this 75% of Schwarzschild radius. And that's what we claim is the boundary of a space-time. And interestingly, when we noticed this, there was a paper that was came out around the same time for Einstein-Eta theories. And they were looking at the stationary solutions in these theories. And they also found a so-called universal horizon, which trap even arbitrarily superluminal ether disturbances. And we believe this is essentially dynamical realization of the same type of static solutions that were found in the Jacobson's papers. So essentially it signals if there's an event that happens here, even if it propagates infinitely fast, if the signals propagate infinitely fast along these surfaces, they cannot exit the horizon, or they cannot exit 75% of the Schwarzschild radius. So one can then basically talk about the so-called, what I just came up with this name about during the last session, the generalized cosmic censorship conjecture, which says that the space-like singularities, such as the one that supposedly formed at the formation of a black hole, are preceded by universal horizon where classical evolution ceases. And by classical evolution, I mean classical evolution in something like shape dynamics or alternates to that. So that's, I have 2 minutes? Yep, okay. And let's see what's next. Oh yeah, so one of the things that's very curious for me is basically the connection to the membrane paradigm. And one thing that we've shown is that if you put an incompressible membrane, I mentioned this earlier, at black hole horizon where classical space-time ends, and this is somewhat inspired by Fireball or Fuzzball proposals, then that membrane has Bekenes and Hawking entropy. You can show that basically from first principles. So we said that there's a boundary of a space-time here at 75% of Schwarzschild radius. But then here, to explain Bekenes and Hawking entropy, we want a boundary at the Schwarzschild radius. So is there any physical effect that can move this boundary from 75% of Schwarzschild radius to Schwarzschild radius? So that could naturally explain, say, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So that we don't know. I think that's an interesting question. So this is my last slide. So I think there are many motivations for preferred framed superluminal theories of gravity. And superluminal could be very large speeds or just larger speeds of propagation. And I guess maximal superluminality equals incompressibility and equals CMC foliation. So this is fact. Now what we showed by looking at this spherical symmetric solution is that there is a universal horizon at 75% of Schwarzschild radius. And for any of these preferred frame theories, that's the boundary of classical space-time. You cannot evolve the equations beyond that point. So this is contrary from what you expect from GR, where evolution is classical all the way to the singularity. Now, what's next? Question is what quantum evolution does to this picture. What would be the microstates of black holes, if any, if you could do, explain them in shape dynamics? What are the observables, and what are the non-observables or censorships that one may conjecture based on this? Thank you.
Questions? I'd be very interested to see this, if you could do for a closed space sections.
Well, I mean, this is basically what we did. But I mean, the questions, I think, didn't make much of a difference. So basically, the idea is that these things were nominally matched to FRW spacetime. It didn't make too much of a difference whether they're closed. I mean, these wouldn't be exact solutions in the limit that they match FRW, but they could do the matching approximately. And at that level, it doesn't make a difference whether it's closed or open or something else.
So your spatial slices here, does it make a difference if you take your spatial slices to be compact or not?
I don't think it would do. I mean, as long as the Hubble radius is much bigger than the size of the black hole. Now, there might be a subtlety there that we missed. But, I mean, we don't have exact solutions. We just do some sort of matching to FRW.
Any other question?
Okay. No, thank you. Okay, so put this here.
From the Center for Creative Fundamental Research and Creative Education in Bangalore. I'm going to talk about geometric quantization and shape dynamics.
Firstly, I'd like to thank the organizers of this conference and this parallel session in particular for allowing me this opportunity, particularly because I had to change the abstract for this talk and to do it. So I shall get on with this then. So as we've heard from Dr. Gomez in the morning and from Dr. Kozlowski and even from Mateo to some extent, shape dynamics is a theory that is equivalent to GR in some respect. But what we have here is the absence of a Hamiltonian constraint. And instead, we have these two first-class constraints, which are those that generate diffeomorphisms and conformal transformations. So yeah. So classically, the extended Hamiltonian that I'm considering looks like this, where that is the true Hamiltonian, which generates dynamics, which generates evolution with respect to the Yorck time. And these are the diffeomorphism and the conformal morphism constraints, respectively. Now, this conformal factor solves the Lichnerowicz-Yorck equation, There's a construction which I won't go into, but basically there's a deparametrization constraint which leads to this Hamiltonian. So the physical Hamiltonian is given by this, as I mentioned. Now, because of this, what we can try doing is we can look at the problem of finding the inner product as completely separated out from the problem of dynamics, because we don't have to worry about imposing invariance under the Hamiltonian constraint. So dynamics and kinematics are separated. So the best way to go about doing that is to consider the BRST construction, where we get rid of having to have invariance under the constraint separately. Instead, we just consider a BRST charge, and we have a differential with respect to that. And the zeroth cohomology with respect to this differential will be the ring of observables in the classical phase space. So since it's a first-class system, the BRST charge is quite directly constructed, like in Young-Mills theories. And we have, so this is an abelian constraint. So the only other terms that pop up with the so these are the Gauss and the Gauss momenta. And the only other terms that pop up with the Gauss momenta in this part are the ones which have to do with the commutation between two diffeomorphism constraints and the diffeomorphism and the conformal morphism constraint. And the BRST differential is given by this, where this is the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to the BRST charge, and this is the extended symplectic form, where the phase space is going to be both the metric and the momentric sort of variables, and this fermionic, anti-commuting ghosts and their momenta. So I'll also get into that in some time. So now this, by construction, is nilpotent because it's a first-class theory, and at least classically, it's going to be nilpotent. And as I said before, the observables are going to belong to the zeroth cohomology class. Now, the phase. If I shall move to the non-minimal sector of the BRST, so that I'll tell you why it's relevant later on. But so doing that is also direct. We just need the two Lagrange multipliers and their momenta, and we extend the phase space by augmenting it with this. And corresponding to that, we have the anti-ghosts and their momenta. And as we know, there's no the momenta corresponding to the Lagrange multipliers aren't really there in the action. So we have two first-class constraints being we have two of these first-class-like constraints which are linear in both of these momenta. And they contribute this non-minimal contribution. They have this non-minimal contribution to the BRST charge. Now, so all we need to do now is choose a gauge-fixing fermion of this form, where I've chosen this Fadiv-Popov-like gauge for these two, Fadiv-Popov-like gauge fixing, basically derivative for these two functions here. And the extended Hamiltonian, which is usually sum of three parts, is just these two because it's gauge invariant under both the conformomorphisms and the diffeomorphism. So we're not going to have the other term popping up here. We're just going to have this, and we're going to have the BRST differential of the gauge fixing fermion. Now I shall move on to the crux of the talk, being the BRST extended geometric quantization. So all quantization efforts that we've had so far when it comes to the metric representation of quantum gravity were done a long time ago in the context of Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. And there, the major problem was that imposing both Hamiltonian invariance under the quantized Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint proved awfully problematic, and there was basically no control over the space of states, and it was basically a very formal construction. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to be exact. It's still going to be a little formal, but we can go a bit further. So now I'm going to try and show you what shape dynamics buys us in this respect. I'm going to try my best to do so. So the geometric quantization procedure that I show here basically follows through in the following steps, being first we choose a polarization of the phase space, and we quotient out the phase space by said polarization. Then we choose, then basically quantization or pre-quantization surmounts to finding a holomorphic line bundle over this polarized phase space, where the curvature of this line bundle will be proportional to I times the symplectic form. And the polarization I choose is going to be the vertical polarization. I put real in bracket because that only applies to the this bosonic phase space and perhaps not this anti-commuting one. And you have to note that the analog of the symplectic form here is not going to give us Poisson brackets. Instead, it's going to give us this anti-commuting bracket when we actually take the form. So they're both going to be spanned by their functional derivatives with respect to the momenta. So in essence, quotienting this out from the phase space, it's going to be something like moving to the configuration space. So basically, we don't need the other. So even if we do the pre-quantization, we still have too many degrees of freedom. We need to cut out half of them. So that's what we're going to do next. And of course, quantization implies that we need to complete this space with an inner product. And that's what I'll be talking about. So so the space of extended geometric quantum states, so this is a pre-quantization condition that I was telling you about. And in essence, there are going to be sections of this line bundle, which is given by this. And these sections so happen to correspond to the ones that ghost number plus or minus m by 2 for m bosonic constraints. This is going to be plus or minus 2 because we have 4 bosonic constraints, 4 times infinity. But we've chosen an appropriate ghost number operator. So we expand. They admit an expansion in powers of the ghosts, and now this size zero and all of them depend on. They're all of the metric. They're all functions of the wave functions of the metric, and possibly the arc time. Since I'm not considering dynamics, I haven't put that in. So this is what they look like. Now the action of the metric is by multiplication, and the momenta is by functional differentiation, and similarly with the ghosts and their momenta. And if you notice, this is like a Clifford algebra with four generators. Four generators. So the ghost number operator, which I choose, is going to be given by this. Now, that's why, okay, so corresponding to this ghost number operator, this state, this big I is a multi-index, where it's each one of these little ones, every one of these indices is included in that. So the highest I, so this is like the highest of the powers that we've chosen before. So the first, very first one is going to have ghost number -2, and this one's going to have ghost number +2. And now, of course, those are not the physical states. The physical states have to correspond to the ghost number 0 singlets. Now, the ghost number 0 singlets, have to be attained to, well, basically they belong to this, but there's this really interesting isomorphism between that and this, where this is the non-minimal contribution only, and this is just the minimal BRC charge. Now, I'll show you how this works in terms of the particular wave functions later, where it's more enlightening. So just given this, the inner product of these states is given by this formula. Now, this inner product is not square integrable in general. And of course, I'm not going to go forward and use it. So it's not the physical inner product yet, or it's not what I purport to be. Now, but it's useful to note nevertheless. So the quantized BRSD charge ought to be nilpotent, but now I have to be really careful. So this was mentioned by Enrique Gomez in the talk this morning. Now, I don't expect there to be anomalies given that the constraint quantization in the Dirac sense is also anomaly-free, because the space of states that I actually get here are the very same as what we get by trying to naively Dirac quantize the BRST extended phase space. But obviously, that's going to give us non-null doublets. So if you want the null singlets, what we need to do is take the non-minimal contribution. So that's why I've done that. Now, so it's something along the lines of, I've written Q. So Q squared psi goes to 0 is basically equivalent in this context to having the proper representation of the constrained algebra and the quantum Hilbert space. Now, I'm just putting a caveat in here because this conclusion has been, I've come to this conclusion due to a private communication I've had, and none of these results have been published as of yet. So let's assume that. Now, I'll skip forward to the main message. So the hope is to tentatively resolve the inner product problem as much as we can, given that we have these very neat properties. Now, what we can't do is, what I'm not going to claim I'm going to do is give you an explicit form of the eigenfunctions of the metric and the momentum acting on the wave function. So I'm going to leave that as an indefinite scalar product, namely saying that it satisfies all the properties except for non-degeneracy and positivity. And so if this admits a decomposition of this form in terms of some basis, then this would look like this. So I don't even know if this is going to be true. So I'm not going to comment about that, because there are several ways to do it, but they're all very formal. And I don't want to do anything awfully formal, any more formal than I already have. But what I can do is, given some inner product between two metric states, I can tell you how to make it gauge invariant, or BRST invariant in this case. And basically, that is to find ghost number 0 states. And that's very simple. We take the eigenfunction, the 0 eigenfunction with respect to all of these operators. And that isomorphism formula I showed you before, that's what it looks like in terms of a wave function. So we're going to have a tensor product between these two. And this is what the each one of the operators acting on it will look like. So obviously it's the zero, it's the zero eigenvalue with respect to eigenvalue with respect to each one of these operators. And it's always going to be BRST closed, and it's going to be BRST exact, only it goes number plus or minus 2. And that's a part and parcel of the construction. Now, but if I just took the scalar product between two of these states, then I'm still going to run into an indeterminate form of, which looks like this. So if I just took psi and psi of this form, it's going to be something like this. Delta of 0 times this indefinite scalar product that I chose of the as a function of the metric. So the regularization that I show here is what gets rid of this. So I'm not making any claims about this as of now. So that's what I'm going to present henceforth. And that's the construction of the physical inner product. Now, I'm sorry, went too far. OK, so up to exact states, we can use the BRST pairing of these two cohomology classes and find a basis expansion for this state, alternatively, instead of the tensor product that I showed before, in this form. So in general, we're going to have something like times a bunch of that times psi alpha. So for the ghost number 0 states, we're not going to see any of those ghost terms cropping up. So the regularized inner product is, so the regularization is going to be of this form. So this is how we go about regularizing it. And explicitly, it looks like this. And this regularizes this up to this indefinite scalar product that I've chosen. So and what this buys us is, at least up to that, we can find the projected kernel of physical observables, quantized physical observables. And they look like this. And basically, this previous slide is like saying, so this essentially is something like the projected kernel of the identity operator. And so in general, for any observable, which is, of course, BRST invariant, the projected kernel will be given by this. So now the conclusion is, due to the simple nature of the first class constraints and the true Hamiltonian generating evolution with respect to the Yorck time, the problem of quantum kinematics and dynamics are separated in the sense that we don't have to worry about the inner product being invariant under the Hamiltonian constraint. And up to this indefinite scalar product, we can feasibly construct a regularized physical inner product. Now, of course, in the future, we definitely have to make something of this, because this wouldn't even work if this were to be 0, and that would be very problematic, or if that were to be infinite. And also, the dynamics is a big problem, because as Dr. Gomez mentioned, and even Dr. Kozlowski mentioned, the true Hamiltonian is a non-local function of the phase space variables. And in this representation, it seems almost impossible to quantize it in general now. Yeah, so these are some references, apart from the shape dynamics ones that I've used. So thank you all for listening.
What's the advantage of combining geometric quantization with BRST quantization?
Well, it's not the advantage. I mean, there's no advantage. It's just that there are several ways to, in the end, construct ghost number 0 states. But I've chosen to use geometric quantization. Because it makes some sense to actually talk about things like the metric acting by multiplication and the momenta acting by the momenta acting as functional derivatives, because actually what we're doing in geometric quantization is so consider a flow of something like the metric or some phase space functional, then I'll write it as f of q and p. Now, in essence, we're doing something of this sort. So the operator will look like this. Now, if you put the momenta in, you'll get the functional derivative. If you put the metric in, you will essentially get the multiplication, which respects the polarization. So it makes a little more sense to talk about this rather than just transformation theory of Dirac. So that's why I chose that. But apart from that, there's no real insightful reason that I can give you.
So you're doing geometric quantization first and then...
Well, not really. So it's like trying to hit two birds with one stone. It's do geometric quantization of the BRST, non-minimal BRST extended phase space, all in all. And luckily, what that gives us is the very same BRST state. It's the, as I said, it's the states which would be equivalent to what we get from Dirac quantization. So, yeah, there'd be it. Yeah, the ghost number that I mentioned.
So can you go back a couple of slides? The problem with the, so you say finite physical improbability is given as, and then you say that this is there is a problem with this because it might still be indefinite.
Oh no, not that it would be indefinite. If this is like zero or something for the eigenfunctions we've chosen, then that's just zero. I mean, there's nothing really happening there, or if it's like infinite or something like that. So, I mean. As you know, in the past, the attempts to construct the inner product is always something like Klein-Gordon, where you have surface element, and you have these states where there's like this. You have this formally written out. It looks like this, and you're trying to impose diffeomorphism invariance in some sense. All of this is, it's all very formal. I mean, you can't even make sense of it. So that is the problem. And it's also a problem in functional analysis because no one knows of a rigorous functional measure, of a functional integration measure on Riemann, as in on the space of metrics. So I mean, this sort of stuff is not really well defined. So that's not something that we have to worry about because that is, as of now, so shape dynamics doesn't tell us anything about that. That's just functional analysis, I feel, so that's why. Yeah,
so. Thank you. If there are no other questions, I would thank Vasudev again.
Maybe up here. I'll use
this
stick.
Slide.
Okay.
We have Jeffrey Osborne from Utah.
Okay. So I am not going to talk very much about quantum gravity, but I am going to talk about a lot of conformal symmetry. And this is work done with Jim Wheeler at Utah State University. We're going to go back 100 years. We're going to talk about Cartan geometry. We'll start off really quickly with something called the quotient manifold method. A lot of you probably know what it is. And really, it started, well, as related to gravity, it started with an attempt to write general relativity as a gauge theory. And it sort of led to an inversion of the standard construction. So instead of looking at an action principle and looking at the symmetries of the action, you start with a Lie group and you look at those symmetries. And then at the end, you build an action that has those symmetries. And Neyman and Regei really figured out how to do this correctly for gravity. Kibble did it, and he ended up having to glue together symmetries. That's why we end up calling tetrads solder forms. He soldered translations to something else, other degrees of freedom. The quotient of a Lie group by one of its Lie subgroups is a manifold. That's the main result that we're going to use. This group, these groups, the first group you get gives you a set of differential equations called the Maurer-Cartan structure equations. They encode everything you need to know about the geometry. These are sort of general connections. You can generalize this connection to allow curvature. We're going to allow the curvature on M, which is our quotient space. And so you'd add a curvature to the side of this equation. The subgroup that you quotient outby becomes the local symmetries of the final geometry. You build a fiber bundle in this way, and then you build an action from the curvatures that you have, which are now tensors with respect to those local symmetries. Okay, so again, this is Neyman and Rege's example. You just take the Poincaré group, you quotient out by the Lorentz group, now you have fibers that have local Lorentz symmetry, you're left with a four-dimensional submanifold, and you have to impose that this has a Lorentzian metric on it, but everything else is given to you for free. Those Maurer-Cartan equations that are given to you, now I'm gonna put all of the torsions and everything in here, but if you took that torsion away, this would be, well, this would be regular gravity without the torsion, it's Cartan-Einstein gravity with the torsion. Okay, so this is the inhomogeneous Lorentz group, the Poincaré group. I can start adding more symmetries to this. So the inhomogeneous Weyl group is these translations and the Weyl symmetry. And then the full conformal group, which is, every time I say conformal, I mean the full conformal group. We have these extra translations, okay? So let's just go back through this real quick. This is the regular spin connection we're used to. The E's are the tetrad that you're used to. This omega with no indices is the Weyl connection. And this F is the special conformal transformations. So they're gonna actually act like, I'm gonna call them co-tetrads or co-solder forms. I might slip, so. So there's a lot of things you can do. You can take this big group and I can quotient by any subgroup I want to. And there's a lot of games you can play, and people did this in the 80s ad infinitum, trying to look for guts and trying to relate them to gravity and things like that. And one quotient that didn't get a lot of attention but was done in the late 80s is the quotient of the full conformal group by the Weyl subgroup. Okay, so let me remind you that the fibers in this quotient, so you have this base submanifold, the fibers will have Weyl symmetry, local Weyl symmetry, and the manifold here will be 2n dimensional. I can do this in n dimensions. So if we're talking about space-time, this will be an 8-dimensional manifold. Okay? And there are two really neat things, properties about this particular quotient that you get. One of them is that you're quotienting in such a way that this manifold is spanned by the E's and F's, so the tetrads and cotetrads. And the dilatational structural equation looks exactly like a symplectic form. Okay, it's spanned by the E's and F's, it's manifestly closed as well. So you get a symplectic form for free, relating the two sort of halves of this manifold. The other thing that's really interesting is that the conformal group gives you a metric for free. You get this, the Killing metric for every Lie group. And it looks something like this. This is the metric between the rotations and the boosts, and this is the dilatational part. And then there's this sector here, which is spanned by the E's and F's. If I did a quotient of, say, the Poincaré group, which is this part of the sector, by the Lorentz group, the metric I would get would be degenerate, because it has this zero sitting here. Of all of the quotients you can do of the conformal group, or the de Sitter group, or anything smaller by something that contains the Lorentz group, the only one where you get a metric that's non-degenerate is this quotient that I'm taking right here. So I get this metric, this Killing metric, projected onto the quotient manifold for free. And that's gonna become important later. And I'm gonna tell you this now, but we'll come back to the curve case in a second. But since the basis forms of the submanifolds have opposite conformal weight, we can write an action that's linear in the curvatures. So I'm gonna write a conformal gravity theory, but it's not C squared gravity, it's not Weyl gravity. So we get around all the problems of having fourth order derivatives or ghosts or things like that. And the action looks something like this. This is the curvature of the Lorentz transformations, the dilatation, and then there's something that's like a cosmological constant. But this sort of, again, we're gonna interpret this, these are canonically conjugate, these two forms. We're gonna interpret this more like a phase space than we are configuration space. And notice that there's no T or S, the torsion or what I call the cotorsion. They don't appear in here because you can't write them in the linear action. So again, we're just sort of writing down the simplest action we can, the simplest or the linear action that we can. And it was shown in the 90s, the late 90s and early 2000s, that if I set the torsion to zero, I can generically reproduce general relativity on its cotangent bundle, where these Fs end up looking like the cotangent bundle of the space-time that we know. Yes.
It's a space space of what?
That's a great question. It's a phase space. So if I look, you could interpret it as the phase space of a particle. That's really what I would think of it as. These E's have a dx in them and these F's have a dy in them. And it's actually been shown. So my advisor worked on some projects where if you interpret this as the phase space of a particle, you can generically reproduce quantum mechanics by you can get an I out in the right place to generically produce quantum mechanics of a particle on this space. But it's a question that's kind of hazy, and the interpretation of this is something that I'm still working on, to be honest with you. So
you reproduce GR in which formulation?
In the ADM formulation. In the ADM formulation.
Aren't these
tetrads? Yeah, they're covariant tetrads.
Right. So
I'll show you. You'll see. I mean, again, there's open to interpretation here. Okay. So what I'm really concerned with, these are the fibers now, but really what I'm concerned is this is an eight-dimensional manifold, and I have this symplectic form on it, and I really want to look at this as a phase space. So I want to define submanifolds of this phase space. The problem is that killing metric has zeros and it's off diagonal. So I really want to have a metric on the configuration side and a metric on the momentum side. And so I want something that looks like this. So these E's and F's are different E's and F's from the other ones. I did a basis transformation. So I want a part that looks like a momentum space, a part that looks like configuration space. And I want some other things there as well. And it turns out that for flat n-dimensional, eight-dimensional biconformal space or 2n-dimensional, it's a phase space with canonically conjugate orthogonal metric submanifolds if and only if the original four-dimensional space we gauge, so the conformal group we look at from the beginning is Euclidean or signature zero where P equals Q. We don't usually look at that case, but it could be interesting. And in either of these cases, the resulting configuration submanifold is Lorentzian. Now, the amazing thing about this theorem is that we can do this. We can look at the conformal group in any signature and in any dimension. And it's through imposing this idea of having a well-defined phase space that we get this signature change, that we get a Lorentzian submanifold, that we get the starting point is Euclidean. We don't impose that. That's not something we're starting. We don't want to start with Euclidean and get Lorentzian. We don't want to get Lorentzian. We want to have a well-defined phase space. And so it's through trying to have a well-defined dynamics, in some sense, that we get this notion of time, that we get this signature change. And this is the metric. So if I start here, this is a Euclidean metric. What happens is I change the sign of, if I put this in the rest frame of this V, I change the sign by one, of one of the directions. So if I put this in the rest frame in the T frame, then I change the sign of that. And I get a Lorentzian metric. So our current work has sort of been trying to combine these. The stuff I talked about just now was a flat result. We're trying to combine it with the curve case to try and get this all to collude together easily. And we've shown a few things. We can actually get this, so this time metric before, there were no field equations. We didn't have any curvatures. It was all flat. And we can get this metric. In the curve case, we actually can recover the form of the metric directly from the field equations as well. There are two new tensors that appear. This V that I was pointing to is it's the Weyl connection plus this is the scale on the metric. Okay, it transforms like a tensor. And there's another one that I'll point to in a second. The Weyl connection, another really interesting thing here is that on these submanifolds, the Weyl connection drops out of the submanifold basis equations. So this is important in the sense that if you have that Weyl vector in those submanifold equations, when you look at the Bianchi identities, they're really odd. They don't look like regular Bianchi identities. There's a d phi still sitting in there, but this omega is gone. And because of the d phi is in there, it drops out when you look at the Bianchi identities. And so you get a regular Bianchi identity for a Riemannian manifold. And then, so one interesting complication of this is that I'm doing this basis change. And I'm starting with the spin connection. that's anti-symmetric with respect to a Euclidean metric. Okay? I do the basis change. I don't necessarily have a spin connection that has any symmetry whatsoever in the basis change that I do, because I'm switching everything around. But so this is sort of my, I just wrote different numbers here. This is where, this is the spin connection you know and love. We're going to say this is a Euclidean spin connection. I do some transformation. So this is anti-symmetric with respect to Euclidean metric. I do some transformation. And a priori, there's no reason this is anti-symmetric or symmetric or anything like that. But the structure equations themselves, when you do the basis change, organize themselves in such a way that the submanifold, so the momentum space and the configuration space, only get the part of the spin connection that's anti-symmetric with respect to the new metric. Not the old metric, but the new metric. And then you get this symmetric part of the spin connection appearing in these mixed basis equations, the things that sort of describe what's going on in the middle. And this thing actually transforms like a tensor in this space. And it actually appears as a source in the Einstein equations. It's a sort of a point of complication of the theory. But I can simplify that. I have two vectors. The v is really important because the v defines our new direction of time. That's something that we want. The mu we've sort of looked at as a bug until recently. So one of the things that you can do is you can set mu to 0. I'll talk about that in a second. Maybe I'll talk about that now. So anyways, I can set mu to 0. I can also put in simple ansatz, a simple ansatz, where mu is made out of v, the other new tensor, the vector. And I can get a bunch of different results here. But I can show that I get general relativity on the submanifolds, except that I have this source if I don't set mu to 0. The dilatational curvature vanishes on the submanifolds. I still have it on this mixed equation, but it's gone from the submanifolds. Dilatational curvature is a problem since we don't measure size change around closed loops. And then one thing that's really interesting here, I think, is that because the dilatational curvature is 0 on the submanifold, this omega is strongly related to the v. This v defines a hypersurface orthogonal manifolds within the submanifolds. So because I have a preferred vector, and this preferred vector through the structure equations, this is the definition of having some vector that's hypersurface orthogonal. So I have hypersurface orthogonal three-dimensional submanifolds, both on the configuration side and on the momentum side, which I find very interesting. And it's all because we have this special vector. The simplest ansatz where we don't set mu to 0 looks something like this, just deltas times v. And if I put this into the Einstein field equations, thank you, then I get something that where the stress energy tensor looks like a dust field. It looks very much like the reference matter that is used in loop quantum gravity, which is also really interesting. I think I probably haven't talked enough about the fact that there is curvature sitting in here. We do get the Einstein field equation, except with this mu thing on the end. So it's we start with this weird-looking action that sort of is more like a Hamiltonian written in phase space. But in the end, we get the Einstein field equation. We also get the Einstein field equation on the momentum side. So we can have a curved momentum space if we want it. And then we have this curvature that describes closed loops, what happens to vectors on closed loops when you go from E to F. We go between the momentum and the configuration sides as well. So we have a very, very sort of general looking space. And I sort of want to conclude with sort of, you guys can read through the comments here. As an advertisement, there's definitely some problems with how to interpret the phase space of this. The coefficients of E describe the gravitational field on E. The coefficients of F describe something. And interpreting what that is a really interesting question that is still open for us. And so we're trying to understand that. I can write down what the Poisson bracket of them is. And I've been working on, after talking to Sean last night, I've been working on a calculation of trying to figure out if E and F are canonically conjugate. I know that you guys in 2 plus 1 found out that they were. This is the coefficient of F is the special conformal transformations. I'm not sure that's going to happen here in general. I think it'll be a simpler case. I think that's a simpler case, which probably is because it's in 2 plus 1. But I can calculate that. So I'm going to work on seeing what that is, actually. But I think that, and this is totally, totally a personal opinion that is not that well-founded except for this list of things here, but I think that if I'm going to redraw Enrique's picture from today, okay, and if this is ADM and this is shape dynamics, I think that the space that we have is the space that these two theories are sitting inside. I think there's some sense in which maybe if we pick it, maybe we have to pick a different action. I don't know. But I know that the geometry itself lends itself well to this. We have all the symmetries of ADM plus full conformal symmetry. We have all the symmetries of shape dynamics plus time-like conformal symmetry plus special conformal transformations. So it's, this is something that I'd like to make a little more rigorous. But this is sort of the end of my advertisement for this. So thank you.
Regarding the Kidding metric that you had, you just have a Lie group G and you have Lie algebra and you have a Kidding form on it, and you restrict that to a Cartan subalgebra of the Lie algebra and you get a Kidding Cartan metric for free.
Right, but so if I look at this, the subalgebra that I'm quotienting by is the Weyl, the Weyl algebra.
You're restricting your Kidding form on the algebra to a Cartan subalgebra of it. That will not change the dynamics whatsoever. And you'll get a metric.
Well, I'm not, so I'm restricting to the submanifold or the manifold I get. So the part of the Killing metric that I was looking at is actually not a subalgebra. It's not a subgroup. So it's not, the Weyl group is not by itself cross the translations and special conformal transformations. Those two do not make a group on their own. So this manifold does not manifestly have group. I can't get a Killing metric from that because it's not a subgroup of the conformal group.
That doesn't have anything to do with what I'm going to talk about. If you have a Lie group, just a Lie group, you don't need to quotient anything. You'll get a Killing Cartan metric for free.
Yeah, that's the big thing that I drew was the Killing Cartan metric to start with.
But my point is that you don't really need to quotient anything.
But you're trying to look at what you want for your local symmetries. So you're picking what you want for local symmetries. You pick by quotienting out by them, whatever you want your local symmetries to be. That's
so
where you take
it. Your main goal is not to get a metric.
What's that?
Your main goal is not.
The main goal is not to get a metric, correct. We were picking to have local Weyl symmetry.
So what is the action for your theory?
Oh, you wrote it down.
No. I did. It's just the most general linear action you can write with our curvatures. So this is the curvature of the Lorentz connection. This is the curvature of dilatations. And this is just, for generality, we have something that's supposed to be a cosmological constant, although it's difficult to define in phase space. So
she said you can't have the torsions.
You can't. If you want it to be linear, you have to have torsion squared terms. And the reason this all works is because these E's and F's have opposite conformal weight, so I can write them linear. And what's odd is if I write these are actually just the mixed terms. It's only when I vary this that I get terms on the submanifolds.
Okay, so how you get two sets, I can imagine how you can get two sets of equations that look like the Einstein equation. One for E, and then you can interpret that as the frame field for the metric. Or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then how do you interpret the other Einstein equation you get for the, that would be the curvature of F or something? Which is like the, what's that thing
so,
doing, and what does it mean?
So that's a great question. So I think the simplest, most naive thing to interpret it as is it's the curvature of the momentum side. So in a relative locality sense or something. I don't know if I've rigorously proved that, but that's the interpretation, is that it's the momentum side. And who knows what that means? What I mean, the relative locality people are busy trying to figure out what happens when you have a curved momentum space.
But we have a question. Can I have a quick follow-up? Oh, I can have a quick follow-up?
just one priority because you have to end up your question.
Because yeah, I was just gonna ask. Do you expect Lorenzo variance violations?
No, no, we don't. And the reason is because I've talked to Giovanni about this, and because we have a metric connection, we have a. It's only when you don't have a Levi-Civita connection that you expect Lorentz invariance violations.
First, Enrique, and then. So, no, it's just a minor comment that that space that you proved there, that's just normal phase space of GR, but the space from which you need to construct both ADM that you get both ADM and shape dynamics from, which we call the linking theory, which is an extended phase space. And in that extended phase space, you do have these extra, all the symmetries together that you mentioned, but you also have more variables.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, you have the same number of degrees of freedom, but you have more variables.
Thank you.
Okay, he wants to say something, but
yeah, I just comparing now. The symplectic form you presented back there, would it be the same thing that I would get by varying this and reading off the symplectic current?
No, it's different. Oh. This is it's a you get a different thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Now, in either of these, are both of these symplectic forms strongly non-degenerate, or will we see some sort of?
I don't know about the one you just asked about, but I know the other one is strongly non-degenerate in the flat case, and it's generically non-degenerate in the curved case.
Oh.
There's only one case where it's not.
Question? Because if not, I will demand further discussion for later, and I will thank Jeffrey again.
Thank you.